Welcome to the Health Edge, translating the science of self-care. I am Mark Pettis, glad to be with you, and I'm with my friend, colleague, Dr. John Bagnullo. John, good morning, buddy.
Good morning, Mark. It's great to see you, and I'm excited to talk about probably my favorite overall topic in the health and wellness field.
Great to see you, and this morning, and probably next week, I think we're thinking this will be a two-part series.
Yeah.
We're going to look at this topic of paleo deficit syndrome. Paleo deficit syndrome, PDS. We'll add another acronym to the alphabet soup out there. But this is such an awesome topic, John, because while it continues to be theoretical in its foundation of humans evolving in modern environments that are no longer that compatible with the biology that drives us, a biology that hasn't changed over many, many, many generations. And while it would seem to be relatively obvious that these changes are wreaking havoc in our quality of lives and in our life expectancy, it still is a context that I don't see or hear discussed that often, John. You know, why it is that we're so sick, and why it is that we feel so poorly, and why it is that the modern medical enterprise, as sophisticated as it is, continues to struggle to find answers and identify root causes, and focuses pretty much on trying to put out a fire without having any real insight into what the origins of the fire are. And here we are. It continues in a way that I think is, the writing's on the wall. We can all see that, certainly here in America and around the world. I love the context for this, John. And there's so much good research that we've talked about through the years, much of it coming from the field of anthropology.
Yeah.
And while the health sciences applaud themselves for their sophistication, many fields like anthropology tend to get excluded from modern medical thinking, much in the same way that we've talked recently, John, right, about physics and quantum physics, and how, you know, this field of physics and quantum physics really has not in any meaningful way been integrated into the life sciences. And so we have these deficits, and what we're talking about today, I think, can add a lot of clarity to how we've gotten to where we are. And I think it'll be a really good discussion, John.
Yeah, I couldn't think of a better one that explains more of the, you know, explains more of the health issues that challenge the modern human being. It's, I think you described it, Mark, when we were talking offline. It's a unifying theory to a large extent, because you can look at every system in the human body, and you can find within those systems, you can find issues that arise from this gap in how our ancestors lived for several hundred thousand years and how we live now. It's unquestionably in my, you know, from everything I've looked at, it is far and away the most unifying theory to put it, you know, the way you did, which I think is perfect. And I for me, it was a, you know, 1997, I believe it's a 1997 paper by Lauren Cordain, was a absolute game changer for me as a graduate student. When I saw his Origins and Evolution of the Human Diet, Implications for the 21st Century, when I read that paper, I don't think I've ever read a paper that has resonated the same way with me on just about every level. And, you know, to your point, anthropology and so many other courses that might be looked at as like on the fringe of medicine, physiology, biology, let's say, so many of those courses, I drew some of the same conclusions that you and I are going to talk about now, this morning. And they were most valuable classes that I took. Zoology, for instance. I mean, just like anthropology provides us a lot of answers in terms of what mammals should eat, what the physical composition of our cells should look like. And, you know, so I think for me, it's an incredible topic because of how it integrates so many of the different things that you and I talk about over the course of a year.
Yeah, and it really takes one out of this material reductionist mindset.
100%.
It forces you to step it back and to look at things from a very high altitude over very long timelines. I'm often struck, John, not to digress too much here, but there's a tendency, I think, and what comes to mind for me is like climate science. You look at data, you know, over the last couple of generations and then draw conclusions that may accurately reflect what you're observing over those last few generations. But the context is this blink of an eye relative to the timelines over which everything on this planet evolved, whether it's climate or whether it's human health and evolution. And so we do tend to, even if we consider these fields, apply a very limited timeline over which we extrapolate conclusions that if we were to really look back at a very high altitude over the origins of our species, origins of health, you would start to see things very differently. And the beauty of this reality that we're in is the ability to adapt. And so we'll look at some of this research, John, and some of the anthropology. And I'm going to bring up a few slides here.
While you're bringing that up, I think I'll probably get right to the point here, because one of the counter arguments I hear repeatedly, sometimes when I have discussions with, you know, colleagues and, you know, people that are interested in this area of medicine, let's call it ancestral medicine, paleo, there's like what we call paleo medicine, right? Just trying to bridge some of those gaps between how our ancestors lived. You know, what I hear repeatedly is, well, people are living longer than ever before. And, you know, you can understand that. I can see where that's coming from. But what I try to say to those folks, Mark, is, well, let's talk about healthy lifespan. Let's try to separate those two, you know, right? Lifespan versus healthy lifespan and quality of life at any given age. What are people capable of doing now at age 30, age 40, as opposed to what our ancestors were capable of doing? Not even, you know, 50,000 years ago, but 5,000 years ago, 500 years ago. Lifespan has increased due to basically our ability to curb infectious disease, right? To our ability to, you know, repair a broken bone. But when we really get down to it and you look at the true health of an individual's systems, I mean, there's no comparison.
Yeah, and there's no shortage of contemporary research looking at cultures today that still embrace ancestral lifestyles that really evade what we would consider in most Western developed worlds to be inevitable outcomes of aging. And so there's so much to be considered here. So we, you know, this concept of paleo deficit syndrome, and we'll look at the paper that we pretty much took this phrase from that was published several years back, really starts from this place of seeing chronic disease, chronic complex disease. We might call that diabetes. We might call it cancer. We might call it cardiovascular disease. We might call it autoimmunity. Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, there are lexicons of chronic diseases that healthcare professionals use in their coding. These are like New York City telephone books of modern diseases and codes that are attached to them for the purposes of billing and et cetera. So, we've just seen this explosion of what we would call modern disease. And it's pretty clear that our ability to adapt can only go so far, depending on the challenges of the environments that we're in and our ability to choose and discern more wisely in those modern environments. And some of this work that we'll look at, John, this, I think, was a photograph from Jeff Leach.
Yeah, it's the Hodges.
These are the Hods. Jeff Leach is, I think Jeff was an anthropologist. Who's done, it's harder for researchers to do field work, to really go to where things are happening and study them. Most academics now are in their labs, offices, institutions. And Jeff spent years visiting with the Hods and learning about them. This is a slide I know we both have used through the years, John, of how we have this, even though we're modern humans, our book of life, our DNA, our biology, our playbook is still very ancient. It's been written over many millennia and written to perfectly adapt to the environments that we were in, which hadn't changed that much really until the last maybe four or five generations. And as we say, from a human evolutionary biologic perspective, that's a blink of an eye. You can't look back at the last few generations and draw conclusions about why humans have become so sick and slow fearful without extending that perspective over longer periods of time. But foods that we grew up on that we would have never thought of as unusual, from a evolutionary biologic perspective, are very much new to our species, and that these are not trivial observations.
No.
And this is the paper. This is a beautiful two-part paper. I think one of our favorites.
That's a great one.
This review of natural environments, ancestral diets, microbial ecology. These are all fascinating dimensions of human life and human health. And this theory, that thesis that we have lost our ability to adapt adequately to so many aspects of our modern environment. And so this paper reviews the research around this. And we were talking offline, John, about how the modern medical enterprise tends to exclude certain fields that could very much change the way we think about health in modern life. And anthropology is one example of that. You see it in physics, particularly, quantum physics. Many aspects of climate science, and we've talked a lot about light and changes in our environmental, the environmental sciences. And, these are all obviously huge dimensions and drivers of our modern experience of life. And so this does just a beautiful job of looking at this through more of an anthropologic lens.
Yeah, it's a really comprehensive paper, and there's two parts to it. I highly recommend that our listeners, take a look at this. I think it's a great, I guess you'd say it's about a 20-year follow-up to Lauren Cordain's paper, because it's all really on the same chord, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly, John. And I'll upload both of these open source papers to the HealthEdge website. It's a great read. And I love this quote, which was in this paper by René Dubos, who was a turn of the 20th century scholar, an author, I look at 1970, John, and part of me feels like that was yesterday. And now I have to kind of remind myself that this was, 55 plus years ago. Human beings can almost certainly survive and multiply in the polluted cage of technological civilization, but we may sacrifice much of our humanness in adapting to such conditions. And the maintenance of biological mental health requires that technological societies provide in some form the biologic freedom enjoyed by our Paleolithic ancestors.
Yeah. It's an amazing, amazing quote.
That is an amazing
biological
statement.
Freedom. Think about that. The biological freedom.
Wow. Right. Our sovereignty, right? This humanness. And so you see many humans today that are unable to walk or, ambulate an incline or maybe lift, a bundle of groceries or maintain enough awakeness later in the day to be able to engage, those fundamental aspects of our humanness have become more elusive. And this too, I know, John, is a slide that we've shared often through the years. Yeah. And, does stress of our present diet, and one could just substitute diet with environment, create an epigenetic change in our health. So while we've made note of this growing mismatch between modern environments and sort of ancient, well-preserved ancestral biology, we had the emergence of epigenetics over the last decade or two, and the mechanistic discoveries that these changes in the environment are interacting with our book of life, and in a way that's starting to change, right? The phenotype. Yeah. This is a phenotype, right? It looking at this graphic reminds me of the old Sesame Street tune, right? One of these things is not like the other.
Yeah.
One of these things just doesn't belong. Well, this is Homo sapiens just didn't look like this or function like this.
And just to remind our listeners, Mark, again, this is the last 30, 40 years or so of the human experience. I mean, I think you could even argue that prior to, let's just use 1970, for instance, because of the René Dubos quote, let's just go back 50 years. This was far less common, that phenotype, than we have today. So this is a very, very, very modern phenotype.
You're right. The warrior is now the couch potato.
Yeah.
And so coming back to some of the research that has been done, and, some of these slides I may have gotten from you, John, through the years. We talked a little bit about the Hadza in Tanzania, but you look at any of the small remaining ancestral cultures that continue to live the way their ancestors did hundreds, even thousands of years ago, you do see a very different phenotype. From Jeff Leach, who as we referenced, did a lot of work with the Hadza, and they can do things that if we were to try some of this, we probably would get very sick, but they've become so adapted to the environments that they're in that you see what I think Jeff would characterize as this incredible resilience at every level. And I find these photographs, they take my breath away. And again, this, you know, no one's wearing shoes, right? They're not, there's no sunscreen or sunblock on these young children. It's a different lifestyle.
Yeah. And I think for some folks, they, you know, they would look at these images, they would listen to this conversation. And I think that they would have a hesitation to kind of buy into the importance of a Paleolithic lifestyle, because they would say to themselves, or for whatever reason, well, this isn't a very different ecosystem. It's a very different population. I don't think that necessarily applies to, let's say, someone living in an urban area in North America. Like, it's just so different. And you know what I say to those folks? I say, okay, well, look at a 1920, 1930, 1940 black and white photo of Coney Island or a beach somewhere. You see the same thing. You see the same phenotype, right?
Yes.
And so it's, you know, what you and I are really trying to drive home here today is, like, you know, we have this constant, almost incessant look at everything through genetics. Well, it's, you know, genetically, this is what I'm predisposed to have. This is the blueprint that I got. And that's just not the case. That we all have a similar blueprint for thriving in this Paleolithic type of or set of conditions. And now we draw on these, you know, these handfuls of modern cultures, like the Hadzes, you know, or the New Guinea Highlanders, you know, not, again, unfortunately, not so much recently with that population because of all the changes there. But, you know, again, you don't have to look at, you know, some really remote, almost exotic place in the world where people are still hunter-gatherers. We could look at, you know, a population 100 years ago and find just as eye-opening of an image.
Yeah, that's such a great point, John. You look at some old film or photographs in New York City back in the, in the 30s. And we're certainly not suggesting that you have to, you know, live in a cave, you know, to realize what we're talking about by way of benefits. There are so many. We have the luxury of being able to integrate modern advances in our lives, while at the same time preserving many of these, at the end of the day, simple, fundamental,
really simple.
Paleo properties of living. And that really captures the essence of the paper of what does it mean to be in paleo deficit, and we'll come back to that. These are all
that's awesome
from Jeff.
That's Leach. Awesome.
Yeah, and you know, these hunter gatherers, they were just well equipped. I mean, look, and I know many of you listening to this can't see the slides that we're sharing, but this fellow has hardly a stitch of clothing on. He's in this wetland, this marshland, right? He's got a couple of spears. He's got a boomerang. He looks like he's got his knife there. I mean, these are the tools of living.
Yeah.
And I love this a little sweatband he's got, right? He's created this, you know, he's not going to let sweat interfere with his ability to throw a spear into a marshland and you know, come away with an animal or a fish to consume from that. And this to the point that you made, John, I think this slide I may have gotten from you originally, looking at the Papua New Guineans, and again, this sort of...
Yeah, that's from a research project where researchers from several institutions, Harvard being one of them, traveled to the New Guinea Highlands to try to explain, it's around 30 years old now though, to try to explain the the physiology of aging in that population, where systolic blood pressure continued to decrease as people grew older and as bone density continued to increase as they grew older. And so researchers were really baffled by this. How can this happen? You know, again, in their context was limited to what they were observing in their patients and in research here in the U.S., which is where obviously blood pressure typically continues to increase as one gets older, and bone density typically is much less at any given age than it was at age 30. So they traveled there, and you know, much to the claim and the observations of those who had gone before them, it was true. And they walked away again. It just with, I think, what could have been really compelling statements about the relationship between diet, lifestyle, and these amazing, this resiliency to aging. But that's not what came out of that paper. It was, again, it's like you were just mentioning about the lack of appreciation for anthropology in this topic overall. It was portrayed as more of a function of an anomaly. Like this, you know, this population is more of an anomaly. Still not quite sure why, but there's only a handful of variables that really explain, you know, what was being measured there. So it's always, you know, it's interesting, and it's hard to say. The cynic in me would say, you know, a lot of these researchers maybe don't want to acknowledge the power that people really have over the trajectory of their health or aging. And I, you know, for a variety of reasons, but the topic comes back time and time again. Look at how these populations live. Look at how, what such a small amount of time sitting. They have no time under artificial lights. They eat the diet that our ancestors would have eaten 10 or 15,000 years ago. And look at the net effect.
Yeah, look at the outcome.
Look at the outcome.
Yeah, this guy looks like he could be working with a personal trainer every other day.
He is a personal trainer. Yeah,
pounding the weights.
He's a personal trainer. Exactly.
Yeah, I mean that. And this is, we've referenced Lauren Cordain, and this is from some of his original work.
Yeah, this is good stuff.
Looking at body mass index in hunter-gatherers and other non-Westernized populations, and from Australian Aborigines to the Inuit to the Maasai, you know, New Guineans, as you just referenced, John. You just do not see obesity. You know, it's rare to see, in the absence of Western infiltration and influence, it's rare to see a BMI outside a normal range.
Yeah, never.
It doesn't happen.
It doesn't. And yet we know, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to get too far ahead of the slides here, but we know that, and I know you're going to get to like Weston Price and his observations in a little while, but we know from just the last 25 years that if we went to places like Papua New Guinea, and you look at this most recent generation who have adopted more of a refined diet, there's rice, right? There's more time sitting. They have cell phones now. That population is very different than the image of the man you saw, you know, whose waistline was being measured. That there are changes that happen very quickly when you get that discord between the ancestral way of life and the modern ones. So, you know, that, again, that is sobering as that is to see how fast things can change and how fast or rapid those BMIs can start to increase. It speaks to this being like, these are not genetic conditions. These are environmental conditions.
Yeah, that's a beautiful segue, John, to this sequence of images here that I essentially borrowed from Robert Sapolsky, Dr. Robert Sapolsky, who's pictured here. He's a neurobiologist at Stanford. And for many years would study primates in Africa and spent a lot of time with these primates and able to measure many biometrics and explore their way of living. And it speaks to what you were commenting on, John, how we now know through epigenetic insights that profound changes in the environment can, in very short timelines, alter the biology of the organisms, and ultimately, you know, their biology becomes their biography, as we like to say. And Sapolsky made these observations in the primates he studied, and like ancient humans, you know, these primates were in tribes. They, you know, there were families of them. They traveled together. They hunted together. They defended themselves together. And, you know, you can see them out in the savannah here. They would groom each other, you know, well known. I mean, grooming is probably one of the more health promoting and in terms of social psychology and human influence. The best way to get someone to say yes to a need that you have is to groom them. These primates very much understood that. And when there was a threat, you know, they would communicate and all find higher ground to evade the threat. And these primates were, as one would have found them probably over the last millions of years, right?
Right.
And then something happened that Sapolsky said, you know, he could have never anticipated. And as ecotourism really started to take off, these reserves that were well protected started to see human trash and waste from where these, you know, tourists would stay and gather, and they would end up throwing this stuff into land areas that these primates then had access to. And in a very short period of time, Sapolsky found what he referred to as junk food monkeys. Literally, within a few years of having access to human garbage, food that was thrown away, most of it, you know, what you'd expect from a hotel, right? A lot of process, a lot of sugar.
Very comparable to what the modern, I'll just say with confidence, the modern American would eat over the course of a day. Very comparable.
Exactly. All these primates start to become heavier. They've got more body fat. They develop metabolic syndrome. And these are measurements. Sapolsky had blood work, you know, had measurements on these animals, and you know, insulin, they were insulin resistant, they moved a lot less, they socialized and played a lot less, their infertility rates were off the charts, and they started to die at very young ages. So you could see how an alteration in an environment could take a species that's been around for millions of years, probably without much change, and inside a few years, you can begin to completely alter the biologic trajectory of those animals. Pretty striking, and I thought, wow, this is a perfect unintentional study of what happens when the gene environment mismatch changes abruptly. And of course, we saw the same thing, right, John? When you look at the Mexican Pimas, Pima Indians, and this is a paper now 20 years old, but it was really groundbreaking, and it's revealing how a very hardy culture upon rapid and profound and unhealthy change in the environment can totally change the health and character of that culture. So here they looked at Mexican Pimas who migrated across the border into Arizona, and the prevalence of diabetes five times higher inside a generation in the Mexican Pimas who migrated to Arizona compared to those that stayed behind, sort of your control group, if you will. I mean, really, I mean, 500% increase. Yeah. That's how powerful epigenetics can be. And so, right, this is Sapolsky's observations applied to humans. In this example, just migrating across the border into an ecosystem that made available less healthy food, less healthy lifestyle. And the ancient warrior Pimas now have kids that are morbidly obese, adults that are less healthy than any generation of Pima before them has ever been, dying of chronic complex diseases at young ages. Yeah. And this is the human equivalent of the junk food monkey that Sapolsky. Right, John? I mean, this is...
Mark, you think about these different examples and you say to yourself, if anybody is still looking for further evidence or feels that we need a double-blinded, placebo-controlled clinical study, you know, then that's just complete denial and in complete lack of interest in truly understanding the root cause of chronic disease.
Exactly, John.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I hear really well-known scientists, clinical people that scratch their heads and say, "Where, you know, we don't really understand where type 2 diabetes." Right. If you go to the ADA website, you know, they'll describe diabetes as a genetic disease.
Yeah.
And hopefully you're not holding those cards. And when it does manifest, you know, we're here for you. And we'll help guide you toward the meds that can best. It's stunning, John, how
it's unbelievable.
How puzzling
it's unbelievable.
Modern diseases for so many that have spent their lives. And I can't help but come back to, and I can say this because, you know, I've come through the fire. There's so much programming in our education that you have to be programmed away from what is obvious to be asking those questions, to be scratching one's head speaks to the power of programming that so many modern clinicians have that, you know, there's so much history there, but, you know, certainly big pharma and the way that education has been hijacked by the medical industrial complex and the, you know, the power players that really drive it, which is largely the food industry, big pharma. And we look in this puzzling way at how can it be that, you know, an 8-year-old kid could be morbidly obese and have type 2 diabetes? You know, let's get more money toward genetic, you know, let's
programming.
Continue to look for the diabetes gene. It's stunning.
It's unbelievable, Mark. And I'll add to the programming. I had a colleague several years ago who I won't name because, you know, this person is in a position of great responsibility and is looked at really closely because of their role for different institutions. But he basically told me, look, it comes down to the three P's: programming, to your point, profit, and power. If you can't profit from a solution, it's not going to be looked at as the solution. It's going to be looked at as something that's, oh, isn't that interesting? Or these are just associations. I love that one when people say with the Pima Indians, well, that's just associations, right? Yeah, well, okay, they're associations, but to your point, a 500% increase with the exact same genetics, there's more than an association there.
Yeah.
So he basically said it came down to programming, profit, and power, that, you know, certain individuals, organizations want to have control over the way diseases are treated, the way we look at things. And if it weren't that way, then this entire topic would be mainstream, Mark. It wouldn't be just a small percentage of clinicians that look at health this way, right? I mean, I think you're so much more integrated into the ancestral medicine field. Like, you understand that they're out there, but if we put all of those clinicians that are part of the ancestral medicine kind of group, or this growing group of paleo type physicians, you know, it's a drop in the bucket, right? It's less than 1%. It might even be less than a tenth of a percent of the clinicians out there. So it's just still looked at as so niche when it's the real deal.
Yeah. Spot on, John. I want to be mindful of the time, John. How are you doing time-wise?
I have around 5 more minutes or so. Okay. I want to come back to this if we can next week.
Yeah. So let me just see where we're at with the slides here, and we'll kind of wrap this up and continue next. Yeah, this is a good place to pause. Next week, we'll talk about the Weston A. Price and the amazing work he did. Anthropologic field work that he did back, you know, decades.
1930s. Yeah.
I have his original first edition book of The Origins of Degenerative Disease. It was so ahead of its time. We'll look at that. So just to bring this first part into sort of a conclusion, John, you know, paleo deficit syndrome, what we're suggesting is that there are so many opportunities in modern life to examine and to implement very modest lifestyle behavioral changes that bring that individual closer to more of an ancestral compatibility without, you know, having to compromise all of the benefits of modern life. And so what we're trying to bring home here is a balance to re-examine where that focal point, fulcrum is, so that one can obviously enjoy all the benefits of modern life, but to be mindful that many of these benefits have unintentional consequences of undermining what are ancestral biologic principles, and to sort of find that balance gives you the best of both worlds. Because what's the point of being in a technologically advanced society with many modern conveniences if you're just too darn sick and feel too darn poor?
Exactly.
Great intro, John.
Yeah, so much fun. And I look forward to next week, Mark. You know, and I know you'll have fun with this as well. You know, giving our listeners a top 10 list of those greatest discords with really simple solutions.
Yes, indeed. It'd be a lot of fun to bring that home. And I think we would recommend to our listeners that this is really the foundation, what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And there are many ways that one can build the house on that foundation, but part of this challenge is re-examining your beliefs in modern life.
Yeah.
And asking the question, who am I? Where have I come from? And that can bring you to a very different place. And John, there's no one on the planet that I know who brings more firsthand insight and experience to this topic than you do. So it's such a joy to share this.
It's a joy to talk about this with you, Mark. It's because I just think it's so empowering to people.
Indeed.
It's so empowering. Even if you can only apply 5, 4, you know, again, I know we're under time constraint here, but I know you're going to talk about, you know, ancestral medicine. It doesn't have to be, paleo is maybe ideal, but even eating a more ancestral diet or living a more ancestral type of life with respect to the light you're exposed to, the movement in your day, you got everything going in the right direction if you get back 100 years from now, right? I mean, it doesn't have to be 10,000 years ago. It could be the lifestyle of 100 years ago. And I know for a lot of people, that's like daunting for them to think about it, but it can be fun. It can be really fun, I think, for our listeners to look at their life and say, what are the areas? Is it with my movement? Is it with light exposures, with what I'm eating? Is it with the window of time I create during the day to be present? It doesn't have to be through meditation. It can be through other activities that really force you to be present. But all of those different dimensions of a more ancestral life take our health in the right direction.
Perfect. Perfect to note to conclude on, John. I'll upload the two-part paper series that we're talking about, as well as the slide deck. Yeah. So if those listening to this want to examine those, they'll be on our website and they can get a bit of a jump start on what we'll continue to cover next week. And so great to see you, John. Well wishes.
Great to see
you,
buddy.
Have an awesome few days.
Yeah.
Stay dry.
I will.
And more to come soon, buddy.
All right, man. I love you. Enjoy the summer.
Love you too.
Thanks.